So let's get some questions on quickly. Okay, dear Ajahn Brahm, could you please give some practical advice on how to forgive someone who's cheated on you several times? So they've cheated on you several times. Oh, why are you suffering? You did, no, you're not to blame. You didn't do anything. So if they cheated on you, every time you remember they cheated on me, you're allowing them to hurt you again. They call you a pig. They call you an idiot. They call you stupid. And what do? You think, they call me all those terrible things. They got no right to call me stupid. I'm not stupid. And you reflect and find out they just called you stupid 3 more times. Every time you remember it and recall it, they call you stupid again. So sometimes when people abuse us and hurt us and cheat us, then why do we keep remembering it? It's not your fault. You should let it go. Ajahn Chah always used to say, if somebody calls you a dog, one of the worst things they could call a person in that part of Thailand, if they call you a dog, you should just look at your bottom, your butt, see if you've got a tail. No, I can't see a tail there. I'm not a dog. I'm sorry, you were wrong. In other words, why are you allowing yourself to be controlled and your happiness to be forfeited when you've done nothing wrong at all? So someone else has cheated you. It's their karma, not yours. For those of you who know Australianism and the way the Australians use their slang, I always say that if somebody's cheated you, abused you, you don't need to seek revenge. Karma will get the bastards anyway. Please excuse us saying there, but all that really means is karma will settle it. Why are you worried about it? So they cheated you, they've abused you, and so you just let it go. But you learn from it. Why is it that we allow ourselves to sort of, sometimes we trust people overly, especially if they're close to us, they're family, friends, or relations. I don't know how many times people get cheated by their family members. It's as if that after a while, that whether it's greed for money, lust for another person, and sometimes that, you know, these people we live with, our friends, our family, they're not fully enlightened. They've got defilements. We've got defilements. And so sometimes what happens, we think, oh, they're my family. They wouldn't do that. Of course they would, as you would sometimes. If temptation is there and it's easy, then people just break precepts. So you have to be very clear. There may be a family, there may be friends, but sometimes when it gets to either money, or sometimes greed, it just makes people do stupid things. Or if it's like lust, passion. I don't mean compassion or dispassion. I mean, you know, passion. Then sometimes people do amazingly stupid things. So they cheated on you. So sometimes you say, well, that's what happens in this life. So you learn to make sure that, you know, you don't allow yourself to get hooked in that relationship, business relationship or emotional relationship. Sometimes you may even be married. Marriage? The 3 rings of marriage? Engagement ring, wedding ring, and the 3rd one?
Suffering,
yeah. So what do you expect? What we expect is that our relationship is special. It's not like other relationships. This is the real thing. This is different. So sometimes we get a bit stupid that way. So it's okay having relationships, but just, you know, just know the dangers. When you know the dangers, you can actually just avoid them, avoid the results, or the bad consequences. One thing I was always taught is to make sure that you try not to put temptation in anybody's way. So in other words, if there's any donations, we make sure we don't leave them around so that people say, oh, you know, well, I'll pay it back later. Well, they never do. Or you don't leave expensive things around. Like, we don't have Rolex watches. Although one monk did have a Rolex watch. He was very proud of it. He was so, look at my Rolex. And he said, it was, I think, $5 from Johor Bahru. It was a fake one. But he's just messing around like that. So try not to leave expensive things around. Then don't put temptation in people's way. And the other thing is, someone's cheated on you emotionally. Then sometimes people can be so little stupid that we always think that we're in control. It's just having a bit of fun. We're just flirting. We're just going around just after a cup of coffee. We're just, you know, just going to some movies together because my husband, my wife, she's overseas somewhere. We're just getting pregnant. So be careful there, because sometimes that's what happens. We just, you know, lose our common sense and we think we're in control. You're not in control. And the other thing is just please never think you're going to get away with it. You will always get busted. And of course, you know, the obvious case was the head of the CIA at the time, General Petraeus. Even though he was the head of the CIA, with every sort of covert piece of equipment and ways of learning how to do things in secret, when he had an affair, he got busted. So if the head of the US secret agency, the CIA, couldn't keep a secret from his wife, you know, you've got no chance. The same with the other way around as well. So it's just not worth it. Because it's a thing with, especially if you're a Buddhist and you're having a relationship, because the honesty afterwards, that really hurts you afterwards. Why did I do that? That lack of trust really sort of starts eating your own heart. So just, if you make a commitment, make it. And the other thing is that if you have, you know, you made a commitment to somebody and you feel some desire or some attraction to somebody else in the office or at work or wherever, tell your partner as soon as possible. Say, like, darling, just, you know, there's a person in the office here that, you know, just, you know, I can feel her, she's coming on at me. I don't really like her. But, you know, I'm telling you because, you know, you're my husband, my wife, my partner. And I just, you know, I want this relationship to carry on. Help me. And so if your partner comes up and tells you they've got some attractions, physical attraction to somebody else, that means they're being honest with you. They want the relationship to continue and they want your help to make sure it doesn't go any further. So if they say that, say, what? You're liking that? That's terrible. Because sometimes when people realize their weaknesses, they tell their friends and then together, you know, that you can sort of make sure the relationship flourishes rather than it all falls apart. It's the same way with if it's cheating in business or something. And sometimes we have to be a bit suspicious. We have to have what's called the old checks and balances. And that's one of the reasons why, you know, that, well, sometimes, especially we had our Katina here, that's the main fundraising of the year. We're raising funds for a monastery down in Albany, which we're building, because we've got too many monks here. And so we raised a lot of money. You know how much we raised? 8,500,000. Cents. It's not a lot of money, 85,000. But that's a lot of money, and sometimes people can go, oh, you know, those money, I don't really need very much, but, you know, I really need a bit. You know, I'm a bit sort of short of cash. I've got to pay this and pay that. My business is not going well. So you have to be very careful to make sure it's counted twice, three times, four times. There's so many checks and balances in this organization. they can't see any possibility way that any money could actually get taken away. Sometimes it's just hard to do things because it has to be counted and banked 3 or 4 times. So anyway, that's why, and that's, I'm glad that happens. And everything gets audited. And when we have, well, even now, well, should I say this? Oh, okay, I don't mind saying this, that you know, where I live, I don't live in Jhana Grove, I live in Bodhinyana Monastery, in my cave. And if you haven't been there yet, there's sometimes during this retreat, if you get a bit bored, you want to walk over to Bodhinyana, meditate in the hall. If you can find a nice friendly monk, can I see your Ajahn Brahm's cave? And of course, you can actually. I'm one of the few people in the whole world whose bedroom is a tourist attraction. Let's go and see just how I live. So, you know, sometimes that openness is really important, which means that, you know, you can't be cheated. So, or you can't, don't cheat. So that's really awful when people you trust, they destroy that trust. So it's just not worth it. So, you know, if it's the end of the relationship, just talk to a person first of all. No, it's not working out. What can we do? Now, can we sort of get it going again? Anyway, I should actually shorten these answers to these questions, I'm sorry, but anyway, I thought it was an important question. Referring to the opening door of your heart, similarly, to heal traumatized individuals, I tried that and inside my heart is a 9-month-old with a nappy opening arms, outside is a traumatized adult. So should the baby hop out of the heart and adult hop in? Thank you. No, there's actually room enough for both of you in there, in your heart. So inside and outside, I'm not sure what happens, traumatized adult or whatever. Sometimes the trauma of our lives, it hurts. You can't force this. It happens like most of the things which I've taught on this retreat. You just got to let it happen when it's the right time for you. You feel it's the right time. You're encouraged. It's all right to actually just to be honest with yourself and with your past, with your life, to allow them all to come in. So, should a baby hop out of the heart and the adult hop in? No, just both come in. I'm not sure if I really understood that question, but whatever. Sometimes there's all sorts of stuff inside and outside. It's best to bring everything in. There's room enough for everybody in your heart. Thank you for your kindness and unconditional love for us. You're indeed a rare gem. Thank you, thank you, thank you. A rare gem. You mean I come from the ground? Dug up in the hole? But no, it's very good. So thank you for saying that. I deserve that. How do you react to that? Because it's just a little thing that sometimes when we're praised, we think, oh, no, it's just okay. Or make a joke of it. Instead, you say, oh, yes, thank you for appreciating me. I deserve that. Because what we're doing there, I'm showing it's good to receive praise. Why is it when somebody praises us, especially in public, oh, no, that's just my job, you know, you're welcome. And say, no, thank you. Because if somebody says something wrong to me, criticise me, Ajahn Brahm, you say the same old jokes every time, we've heard that story, we go on too late at night time, oh yes, yeah, I agree with you, that's absolutely true. So human beings receive criticism. We keep it. We reject praise. Which is weird. So the next time somebody praises you, they say, oh, wonderful thing you did. Great breakfast you make every morning for us, David. The baked beans, I don't know how, it must be the way you open the can. And so what do you say? So, yeah, it is actually. I've just been training how to open the can, how to eat it. So you receive the praise. Because too often we just receive criticism. And the praise, we reject. Which is weird. So, try it the other way around. When you get praised, thank you. You get criticised, oh, I'm just having an off day. Just like Nasruddin. And that story, remember that story? When you hit the bullseye, who was that? That was me. You often quote that as in Majjhima 50, Sanjeev was not harmed by fire. Oh yeah, that was the Brahma, Tejanya. Not harmed by fire, even after being cremated alive. You say this was because of the invulnerability from being in jhana, but in the suttas it says he was in a state, that's right, neither of cessation of perception or feeling, which is not classified as jhana, but it's like a deeper than a jhana. It's based on a jhana, it goes deeper. Are you saying even in the first jhana one becomes invulnerable? If so, would it be fair to say that there's no evidence in the suttas of this? Pretty much so, because there's not much evidence at all in the suttas about things. But there was that fellow, who was Indonesian monk, who was found. Oh no, who was submerged for many days. And there was also the cases of that Sri Lankan young man, who the doctor just could not cut his skin. When he was in a, and I don't think it was a cessation of perception or feeling, it was just a jhana, well, just a jhana, just they're pretty good. And of course, the other story, which I haven't said at all, this is not evidence in the suttas. The suttas are just are a lot of information, but it's also the evidence which, you know, we have in our experience of meditation. And that was the case where somebody, the disciples, his name was Greg, it was quite a few years ago, I haven't seen him for a while now, but he was, used to just meditate just half an hour, maybe, at home. And I wrote about him in the book, Mindfulness, Buddhism and Beyond. And this gentleman, Sunday afternoon, nothing on TV, you know, about 30 channels, but, you know, 60, I don't know, but nothing which interested him, so he went into his bedroom to meditate for half an hour. And after 45, 50 minutes or something, his wife went to check on him, and he was sitting perfectly still there in his bedroom, meditating. And the problem was, it was too still. You know, his abdomen wasn't rising and falling at all. It was perfectly still. And to all intents and purposes, it looked like he wasn't breathing. And his wife just looked at him, checked on him, and really got scared and called the ambulance. When the ambulance came, and just the medics ran in, they checked pulse, no breath, no discernible pulse. So straight in the gurney, in the back of the ambulance, to Sir Charles Gardner Hospital. It was a Sunday afternoon, and doing that stuff was actually an important part of this story, because I'll tell you later on that when he actually got into the hospital, now, straight rushed into the triage. The triage couldn't see any sort of sign of life. They put on an ECG and EEG, both flatline. No discernible brain activity or heart activity. And now, this is, you know, what they said. Some doctors said they don't do that these days, but this was quite a few years ago. They gave him defibrillators on his chest. I think these days they inject, adrenaline, yeah. But anyway, they put the defibrillators on him, and he didn't feel a thing. Also, nothing worked, it was still a flat line. And his wife was, you know, pretty sort of anxious, as you would be. But then the doctor on duty was of Indian extraction. His parents had migrated to Australia. He was born in Australia, he's a medic, a doctor. And he had heard his parents say that sometimes in deep meditation and samadhi, you can suspend your life activities. And he'd been meditating before. And this was an interesting part of the story. The doctor also noticed something strange, that his body was warm. It hadn't cooled down at all. And if you look, I think it's in the Mahavedala or Churavedala Sutta, they say that's one of the differences between somebody in deep meditation and somebody who's dead. You're still warm. And so they decided to carry on with the defibrillators, and nothing was working, flat line. And he didn't tell me how long it was, but obviously a considerable time. And then he decided to come out of his meditation. Simple as that, that's what he said. Time to come out. And all that time he'd been perfectly mindful, really aware, blissed out, and not being able to feel defibrillators, hear the sirens, hear the medics trying all these things to try and get him working again. And all the time he was totally blissed out in a deep meditation, just with the mind, not the five senses, and sort of couldn't feel anything, even defibrillators. It was a beautiful story. And afterwards he said, you know, when he came out of his meditation, he bent up, and, where am I? You know, I was in home, what am I doing in hospital? And, of course, as soon as he came out of meditation, opened his eyes, beep, 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 the ECG and EEG monitors were normal. And the doctor just gave him a thorough checkup, couldn't find anything wrong with him. And so he said, you better go home. So he walked home with his wife, not even an ambulance, after that experience. And he said it was an entirely pleasant experience, except for one thing. And that was, he said, the scolding he got from his wife on the way home. Don't you ever do that again. You have me worried sick. Don't, no way. And so that was interesting, just sometimes what happens in these deep meditations. So sometimes the one who could not be burnt, you know, that was, you know, obviously that's supposed to be in the Nirodha, the cessation of all perceptions and feeling. And the other ones would be in the jhanas, but not that deep. So he was perfectly mindful all the time, blissed out in one of the jhanas, and could not feel any. So what's actually happening there in those cases is that your five senses are stopped, and you're not feeling anything. And for that reason, there's some invulnerability. What would harm you in other circumstances is not harming you now. And that also that thing, the guy could not be penetrated by a scalpel with the doctor. So there's some interesting stuff going on there. What happens when you're in deep meditation? And I like that stuff. Unfortunately, it's very hard to do this in laboratory situations. To get someone to go into a lab and say, okay, you go into jhana now. We're now going to burn you and cremate you, see if it works. So that's why this is always just anecdotal evidence, but even so, it's fascinating that, you know, such a thing could exist. And I always, like as a theoretical physicist before, those are the things which always fascinate me. The interaction between the mind and the body. And sometimes the supremacy of the mind. I'm just rabbiting on again, but this is interesting. One of the experiments which was done in hypnotism, which many of you may have seen or heard about, they got this gentleman and put him under in a trance, under hypnosis, and they had a stick. On the end of the stick was a 4-inch nail, and they convinced this person that the nail was red hot at a very high temperature. So they touched the nail on this gentleman's skin. He screamed in pain, which I could imagine. You felt it hurt. And it did hurt. But what I never expected to see was to see a blister come up. There was a physical wound, a burn. And the nail was just at room temperature. A baby could just hold it and would not even get hurt at all. But it created a wound just because he thought it was hot, burning hot. So that wound, that burn, that blister was mind-made. If the mind can make a blister, then maybe it can shrink a tumour. The mind does have these abilities. Sometimes people don't even believe him, but sometimes it's there. And there's too many of those things happen. You know, that sometimes the doctors say, we don't understand. But sometimes, where you don't understand, as a scientist, that's where you should do your experiments. Find out what's going on. Anyway, I discovered an effective method to make walking meditation come alive. Just imagine you're a top model sashaying down the catwalk, making every muscle and sinew radiate love. Maybe you or the junior monk can demonstrate. I think I'm past it. And even Venerable Savino is the same age as me. And anyway, we have a saying in our monastery, whoever comes up with a good suggestion has to be the one who does it. Anyway, don't blame me. The nuns put me up to this. By the way, okay, so who was it? You're not going to confess and get into trouble. So whoever said it, they have to do the sashay. By the way, can you explain Nibbida? Nibbida is what you experience when you see me trying to sashay like a model down the catwalk. Oh, this is terrible. Nibbida is I used to call it samsara, like a wheel of samsara going around, the ejector seat. In other words, it pushes you off, rebirth. And how to cultivate this to empower meditation? You can't cultivate it. It just comes up when you see things as they truly are. What am I doing this for? It doesn't make any sense to me. You know, why am I just holding on to stupid stuff? You know, like the past, and he cheated me or she cheated me, and it, you know, it was an unfair. You know, if somebody has, you know, broken the relationship, yeah, now I'm free. It was weird, but, you know, that when my girlfriend, my own girlfriend years ago, dumped me for somebody else, I'm so grateful to her. Well, without you, you know, I might have ended up getting married and having kids and never becoming a monk. So if you ever see that old girlfriend, you know, years ago, oh, thank her, thank you so much. He was like that guy at the cemetery, sort of crying his eyes out. And he said, you know, what are you crying for? Was that your father or your mother? Or is it your ex-wife? He said, no, it's my wife's ex-husband. If he hadn't have died, I would have... if he hadn't have died, I'd be happy. The wife's ex-husband, the first husband. He was the second husband. So his first husband... okay, and how can to cultivate this to empower meditation? First of all, it means that you just don't worry about stuff. Because and all that, it's amazing what people sort of waste their time thinking about. You know, just so you get nibbida towards that fame and fortune and praise and blame. No matter what you do, you always get praise and get blame. You know, I get blamed for things I didn't do. I also get praise for things which I didn't do also. But I take that and... So the whole thing is just a scam. Anyway, dear Ajahn Brahm, thank you for all your teaching. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Yeah, I told you I deserve it. Do you have any good stories about Ajahn Sumedho? Good stories about... should I tell this? he's a really good monk, but what he did once... that's a really nice story, an inspiring one. The other ones were maybe not so inspiring. But there was, you know, he was the first abbot of Wat Nanachat, and we had the tradition, the rule, that if you wanted to become a monk, to ordain, after being a novice, to get the full monk ordination, you had to make your own robes, the own set of three robes, which was, you know, a lot of cloth, which you start off with white cloth, and you had to cut it, sew it, and, you know, it takes a huge amount, about 20 hours to actually to make a full set of robes. It's very complicated. Once you've got it in white cloth, then you have to wash it to get the grease out, and then you have to dye it. And the dyeing of this, you know, it was done with a natural dye. It was done with the wood from a jackfruit tree. You know, when any tree fell over, when it died, or a branch fell over in the storm, they'd take it to the monastery. And we'd using a machete, which you had to sharpen yourself up on a, sharpen up yourself on a stone. You'd actually chop the jackfruit log into little chips, slivers of wood, and a lot of them to get the, enough dye for a triple set of robes. And then you'd have to get the water from the well. There's no taps. So, you know, I learned how to sort of, not from a rope and bucket, you know, the old bamboo sticks and the little hook on the end, and you put a bucket in there and you'd scoop it up. It took a while before you learned how to do that and pick it, bring it up. And once you had some water, then you had to go and with a big bowl, which you'd put ash and water on the underneath to stop it sort of getting dirty. And then you start a fire with wood, which you collected yourself, and just boil up the water and then put in the chips of jackfruit wood, and then boil and boil and boil it until some of the dye came out. And then you put it in an earthen pot and get some more. When you had enough, you concentrated it by boiling it and boiling it until it was quite a thick brown paste. I'm not brown liquid, maybe just like, oh, just a thick coffee, like soup. And then you get your white robes, you put them in an earthen basin, which you chipped out yourself, and then you put the robe in, put the hot dye on top of it, and pound it with your own hands, pounding it, turning it over, pounding to let the dye come in. And then you put it on the line, and you could not leave it. You had to keep on turning it so the dye was even. And you had to do that three or four times to get enough dye into your robe. So it was really labor intensive. What it was showing was that, you know, the monks really wanted to become monks. It was really hard work, usually about 3 days. And those 3 days, often you didn't sleep. So this was, I think, three monks or four monks were ordaining. And they were making their robes. And after the second night of them making their robes, you know, I always was a compassionate, caring monk. So after the evening meeting, you know, the chanting and the meditation, maybe a talk sometimes, about 9 o'clock, 9:30, I went to the dyeing shed, you know, where they were doing all of this work. And these three or four monks were exhausted. And I said, I know this is against the rules, but no one will see us. You guys go off and take a rest, and I'll look after the dye pot by myself tonight. You know, they never argued. They were off like a flash. Because if you've ever gone without sleep for about 2 days in a row, you feel terrible. And so I was out there until 3 a.m. 3 a.m. was when the bell went, when we got up. And they came up, just having 3 or 4 hours sleep, just took the edge of the, you know, the suffering of sleep deprivation, no, big sleep deprivation. So they came back and they took over. And I just went to the morning chanting and meditation, hadn't slept all night. And I was just really full of energy. There's no sloth and torpor, no tiredness, and I hadn't slept all night. And then when I went off for the arms round, I was just so alert, so alive. And then on the way back, I asked Ajahn Sumedho, so what's going on? Look, I confess, I broke the rules. I helped my fellow monks or their novices to make their robes. But, you know, I feel so full of energy. You know, what's going on? I haven't slept all night. And he just said, that's what happens when you do selfless service. You know, the energy which I lost from not sleeping, I more than gained by helping some friends who really needed some help. And I've noticed that a lot in life. When you really do service and you help others, you know, you donate your time, your energy, your money, whatever it is, that gives you a big boost of energy. You feel so good about yourself and good about life. And it was like free energy. So, you know, you don't just get energy from coffee or tea. You get energy from so many different sources. And this is inspiration. You really help others and you get so blissed out that this place, Jhana Grove, sort of, now look at Bianca. Does she get paid? No. She does so many retreats here, just serving, just cooking for you, making sure you're, everything you need is there. And she doesn't get paid at all. She doesn't get a stipend. She just does this because she loves it. She gets so much energy out of that. Now, have you got, I notice my back is straight now, and no tiredness at all. You get energized from these things. Energized from inspiration. So that's what I learned from Ajahn Sumedho. He said, no, this is what happens when you serve others. That's a nice story. So, never get up there. That's why I open doors for you. You know that. It's a bit of play, but it's a bit of fun. That gets some energy up. I do practice what I preach. Opening the door of your heart, I'll open the door of the meditation hall for you. On the night of his enlightenment, the Buddha developed three knowledges, the first of which was a recollection of his past lives. But it struck me the other day that if this was the case, wouldn't he have seen the path to enlightenment than he had been a disciple of previous Buddhas, so the Four Noble Truths weren't exactly a new discovery? Yes, well done. Well noticed. Even there he said that the Buddha discovered an ancient city in the jungle. And the path leading to it was overgrown. It was the Eightfold Path. So it wasn't exactly new, it was just overgrown for a while. And he just rediscovered it. It's just like, did Captain Cook discover Australia? It was there before he came. So it's saying discover these things, there's something very wrong with that. So he was there before, but that's exactly true. The Buddha developed the three vijas, first of which was the knowledge of past lives, second, the law of karma. Once you know how past lives are, you know how karma works. And the last one was just the end of the defilements, the full enlightenment. But if the first one was the knowledge of past lives, that's this in the Gatikara Sutta, and it's very, very clearly stated that the Buddha was a monk under, that our Buddha, Siddhartha Gautama, was a monk under Kassapa the Buddha. His name was, I always get this wrong, Jyotipala. Or Jyotipala, I think it was Jyotipala. Yeah. So it's Jyotipala, a monk under Kassapa the Buddha. And so if you were a monk under the previous Buddha, now you'd have heard the Four Noble Truths, you'd have heard some incredible teachings. And that was the first thing which the Buddha remembered. I was under the Bodhi tree, the first vijaya. I remember his past lives, and this would have been a big one. And also, again, so he would have remembered that. So he didn't really discover it. It was conditioned into him. It was where he got it from. You don't do these things by yourself. That will is coming from an external source. The words of another, Paratagosa. For Siddhartha Gautama, it was a previous Buddha. And there's even Brahma Sahampati, who came down to see the Buddha. He was also apparently one who said, please teach. There are beings with little dust in their eyes. So please teach out of compassion for them. They'll understand the Dhamma. He was also a monk with Kassapa in a previous life. He was an anagami, non-returner. And Gatikara himself, he was the mate of Jyotipala in the previous life. He too was a non-returner, and so he came down to congratulate the Buddha. We were in the same village in our previous lives. They said in a previous life. we were in a village, and you got reborn and became a disciple before you were, we were disciples of Kassapa the Buddha. Now you got reborn, and now you're the new Buddha. Congratulations. Well done, mate, as they say in Australia. I congratulated him. That's a fascinating evidence. And to say that not only knew the Four Noble Truths from the previous Buddha, wouldn't it be the case if you had such great spiritual qualities, what they call the paramita, you've got such great spiritual qualities, surely you'd have achieved something, you know, under Kassapa the Buddha. And so, what circumstantial evidence have we got that the Buddha achieved something? He was with Kassapa the Buddha, and that he came into this last life in the Tusita realm. And I think Senanguta and Kaya, they say, once returners, Sakadagamis, are for the most part reborn in the Tusita realm. So the evidence says he came from the Tusita realm down here, and as soon as he was born, he put up the one finger, this is my last life. How could he have known that? Unless he was a once returner, as he came into this last existence. This was his last life as a Buddha. Now that's not just Ajahn Brahm making this stuff up, because that's also in the Katawatu, Points of Controversy, part of the Abhidharma. And it says that, no, that didn't happen. But the Katawatu was after the time of the Buddha, so you can argue with it. Evidence actually suggests that was the case. You need a seed from something else. Something the Vajrayana keeps on calling transmission. Yes, there's transmission in Theravada too. The inspiration, the teachings, the power to go to the words of another, and that also applies to a Buddha. He got that seed from somebody else, the previous Buddha. Da 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 da. Next question. Yay! Woohoo! I am on Ajahn Brahm's retreat. Whoop whoop. Yeah, same as me. Okay, I can leave it down there. It's okay. Very good. That's very nice. Dear Ajahn Brahm, when a vet has to take the decision to euthanize a pet solely because the owner has financial constraints, who does this bad karma go against, the owner or the vet? Against the cat. Why should the cat get away with it? The cat should have actually lived a more healthy life, eaten well, exercised instead of sleeping all day. Cat's fault. Why should the cat get away free? The poor old owner or the vet, you know, has to take the blame. I'm only messing around. But there was this book called Erewhon, Nowhere Spelled Backwards, by this fellow Samuel Butler. And this was, it was like a sci-fi, something like a Gulliver's Travels, a satire on the modern life. And there, they imagine this country which, you know, had grown up by itself, never been visited by Europeans before. And in that country, that if anyone got sick and ill, they were taken to court. They broke the law for being sick. And there was a scene there where there was this man who was a repeat offender, and he was in a court for having a cold, having the flu. And the judge said, "Sir, this isn't the first time you've appeared before me. You got the flu, it's obvious, I can see the symptoms, and you are a danger to other people. You're infectious, and you are not putting your weight in society by doing any work, you're always off work, and other people have to look out. And I warned you last time, sir, if you appear before me with a cold again, I'm going to literally lock you up. So I sentence you for 2 years." in jail. I'm sorry, I have remorse, I didn't mean to catch a cold. Well, you should take better care of your health. Eat better, exercise more, do more meditation retreats. He didn't actually say that, but... Isn't it your fault if you get sick? Don't you have some culpability if you get the flu or you get a heart attack? Isn't it that you didn't see the signs and you abused your body with alcohol, not sleeping properly? Don't you have some responsibility for your health? And if you get sick, isn't it the case that the government has to spend so many resources looking after you while you're not productive? So in this society, becoming sick was a crime. But if you did a crime, you know, like, you know, you stole from your company, that was considered to be an illness. Yeah, it was because, you know, you know that you weren't earning enough or you needed something or you had some psychological problems. So if you actually did what we called a crime, that was considered to be a sickness and you were sent to the doctor. It was turning around sickness and, say, thieving or what we usually call crimes, turning them around. People who do crimes, are they really fully responsible? Is sometimes society responsible? There was a very inspiring case of, a real case happened in I think, Sumatra, in a village there, or a little town. A poor woman stole a breadfruit from a market store. And the owner of the breadfruit store caught her, had her arrested. She had to be tried according to Islamic law. And the judge, the magistrate, said, "Why did you steal that breadfruit?" And she said, "My husband ran away, I don't know where he's gone, probably to Jakarta or something. I've got a couple of kids, I don't have any income to feed them, and I stole this breadfruit to feed my kids." It's just straight away that those of you who know Victor Hugo's great book, you know, Jean-Paul Jeanne, "Why did you steal that bread?" That's the Les Miserables. "Why do you steal that bread to feed my kids?" How can you actually sort of criticize that sometimes? Victor Hugo, this ethical dilemma. You know, what would you do if your kids were so hungry? Would you steal? Is that greed or is that need? Well, anyway, in this particular case, modern case, the judge turned to the plaintiff, the owner of the bread store. "Look, can you forgive her and let it go? You have the chance to do that. If you say, 'Oh, never mind,' the case is dismissed. You have that power in Islamic law." He said, "No! You know, if you let her go, then someone else will steal." So the judge had no choice. "It's obviously you stole." And so he's pressing charges. "I can't do anything else except to fine you. And I fine you the equivalent of, say, $100. And she burst out crying. So how can she ever pay $100? What was it? What was that? It's about 110 million rupiah or something. Is that right? I don't know, but a lot of rupiah, Indonesian currency. How could she pay that? She didn't have any money. If she had that sort of money, she, you know, would be able to buy the breadfruit herself. Wouldn't need to steal it. She was weeping, not knowing what she would do next. And then the magistrate interrupted and said, "And also, I have the right, and I'm going to exercise that right, to fine everybody in this courtroom $10 each for letting a poor woman have no food for her kids and forcing her to have to steal. That is your crime of social irresponsibility." And he took off his judicial hat, put sort of 10 bucks in, he fined himself as well. Passed the hat around, and everybody in that courtroom, including the owner of the food store, had to put $10 in. And when it came around, it was about $1,000, all the 100 people in there. And he said, "I'm taking 100 to pay the fine, and the rest, $900, is for you, madam." He said, that's justice. And I thought, that was a wonderful thing, because if someone is that poor they have to steal, we should be fine too. We've created a crime of putting a person in a situation where they have to steal to survive. Interesting ideas of justice. So anyway, a vet has to take the decision to euthanize a pet solely because the owner has financial constraints. It has to be the owner's decision, because apparently, according to Australian law, the vet can't just do it. You have to ask permission from the owner. And so it is the owner's karma. But it's also maybe the cat. It's good. The cat knows it's only got 9 lives. So, you know, it should actually just pace them out. Don't keep running across the road. Don't think that you can fight the dog next door. Are these talks recorded? I hope not, otherwise I get in big trouble. I think they are. How can we watch them later? Are they on YouTube? Well, I don't ask the management. That's Christina, she will probably know. There's this story that I've heard you tell before a long time ago, but I couldn't remember it anymore. Neither could I remember the context of why the story was told. It was the one involving opening various doors with various keys to someone who first has to become a monk to know the secret. Would you mind retelling that story again if there's enough time? That was the story of this Australian man who went on a tour up in, I think, about the Ladakh area, you know, just, you know, the foothills of the Himalayas, you know, on a trek. And you know, the Australian guy, he was, you know, busy taking photographs, he wasn't following instructions, and so he was lagging behind. He always thought he would catch up, but he realized that, you know, because he couldn't see the rest of the party, he took a wrong turn and got lost and separated from the rest of the party. Got, you know, totally lost, you know, in the foothills of the Himalayas. And he, you know, he thought he no real danger, but then it was late in the evening, the sun was going down, it was getting very cold, and he realized that, you know, he was in trouble. So fortunately he saw some lights in the distance, and not that far away, he managed to get to them before it got too dark. It was a monastery. So, you know, they let him in because he was a traveler, compassion, and they gave him something to eat. And the abbot said, oh, we know where that tour group rests for the night, so we can't take you now. You can have somewhere to sleep tonight. And the abbot was so kind, realizing it was a Western, they can't sleep on the floor. The abbot had a sort of a nice bed. He gave him his own bed in the abbot's room. You sleep in my bed tonight. I'll find another place. So he slept there, and in the morning, actually not in the morning, just as he went to sleep that night, around midnight, he woke up. You know, sometimes when you're in a new bed, you know, unfamiliar surroundings, sometimes you don't sleep that deeply. He woke up in the middle of the night, just before 12 o'clock, because he started hearing this weird sound. And the weird sound he heard was like music. It was like some symphony, but more beautiful. If you take your favorite music, now what I used to like before I became a monk was choral music, like Monteverdi was some of my favorite music. Imagine that, but now even more refined, like otherworldly. And it was thrilling him. And he didn't want to go to sleep. He was just listening to this and listening to that, you know, crying with the beauty of this music. And then that's the last thing we remember, just being lulled to sleep by the most amazing music he'd ever heard before in his life. And he'd been to great symphonies in the Sydney Opera House. But when he woke up in the morning, the abbot gave him the breakfast and assigned a monk to take him so he could meet the rest of the party. But he had to actually ask, you know, just last night around midnight, I heard this most beautiful sound. Now, what was it? And the monk said, oh, you heard that too, eh? Said, yeah, I heard it. What was it? He said, look, I'm sorry, sir, I can't tell you. And the monk, the visitor, the Australian, said, okay. He opened up his wallet. Here you go, $100. He said, no, it's not a matter of money. I can't tell you. Only monks can know that, the answer to that. So he got a couple of 100 out. Look, you can give me 1,000,000 if you want to, but I still can't tell you. Now, only monks can know the source of that sound. And all the argument, all the promises, trying to write out a check, no. The abbot was really firm. So he said, well, you better go now, otherwise you'll miss the group again. So he had to go. And so he found the rest of the trekking party, and he came back to Sydney. And when he was in Sydney, he couldn't get this music out of his head. And so bad, he went to a therapist, a psychologist. And whatever the psychologist did, he could not get out. It was bugging him everywhere. And he was like obsessing about it. So eventually the psychologist said, well, the only thing you can do is go back to that monastery and find out. So 1 year later, he went back to Ladakh. He managed to find that monastery, knocked on the door and said, look, I'm going crazy. I'm so obsessed with this amazing sound. I have to find out what it is. And the abbot said, look, I remember you and I told you last time. I can't tell you. Only a monk can know that. He said, exactly. Ordain me as a monk. He said, well, I can't just ordain you. It takes a couple of years, you know, to get full ordination. So I don't care. I'm going crazy, you know, without knowing this. So however long it takes, however long I want to train, stay in this monastery, ordain me as a monk. So he started the whole process of training, 2 years, to become a fully ordained monk. And of course, just after his ordination, he went up to the abbot 2 years later, actually 3 years after hearing the sound the first time, said, right, I'm a fully ordained monk now, tell me what that noise was. And the abbot, always honest, said, well, I can do better than that, I'll show you. Come to my room, 12:45, and I'll show you. And of course, imagine how excited, 3 years waiting to find the source of this most amazing sound. And so 12:45, actually 11:30 he was there. 12:45 he went in, the abbot was waiting for him. And he just gave him a little talk, first of all, about, you know, you're going to find out something which is really quite amazing and supernatural. You must promise you can't tell anybody else. Only monks are allowed to know this secret. So he promised and promised and promised. And the abbot also warned him that this is something which was really weird and strange. Are you prepared emotionally to actually to know what the sound is? Sometimes it can, supernatural weird stuff can sometimes send people crazy. And he said, look, I've got no choice. I'm going crazy as it is. I have to know. Okay, he said. About 5 minutes to midnight, he pulled a curtain on the back of his office, and behind that curtain was an old wooden door, ancient. And some of those monasteries have been there, no one really knows how long. And he took out an old bunch of keys. And he first put this wooden key, you know, into the hole, turned it, and opened the door. It was creaking. It hadn't been open for maybe decades, who knows, maybe a century. And then as he walked through, he saw this really dark corridor. And he was actually trembling with excitement, as you would do. 3 years he was waiting for this. And now he's about to hear it. And actually more than that, see it. And as they went further down the corridor, he could see there was an iron door was the next one, an iron door. And he got to the iron door. You want to go through? Said the abbot. Yes. So he took out this old rusty iron key, put it in the hole. It took a while to turn it because it was pretty rusty, it hadn't been used for a long time, and pulled the door as the iron door opened, really heavy. And when he opened that, the music started. Amazing, thrilling stuff. You know, he was trembling all over and tears were streaming. Even the abbot was crying because it's so incredibly beautiful. I don't know what your favorite music is, but you know, this is multiplied by a million and that's what it sounds like. And so he was walking, trembling. He saw the end of the next passage. There was a silver door. And that silver door had been mined from the mountains, really thick, again, be worth a fortune. You want to go through? Yes. So he got out this really hardened silver key, opened the silver door, and then he saw there was one door left. He assumed it was the last door because it was solid gold. encrusted with priceless rubies, sapphires, I don't know what the jewels are, but it's the sort of thing which, you know, you'd have to be a billionaire to actually to buy. It'd been made a long time ago. And as they got close to that last door, the golden door, you could hear the music even more clearly. He was shaking with excitement and with bliss. And the abbot stopped at the last door. He had the golden key in his hand. He said, "Do you really want to see this? It will change your life forever. Are you prepared?" And he realized, the Australian realized the gravity of this situation. This was no joke, this was really intense. Is he ready for it? And he considered, even though 3 years it took him, he really thought, maybe I'm not up to it. That's how just important this was. He realized this was something out of this world. But then he said, yes. So the abbot opened the door. And as he opened it, you know what he saw? "I can't tell you. You're not monks." Oh, I got a sadistic streak in me. If you had heard that before, "You wound me up. You wasted 10 minutes of my life and I won't tell me." Okay. Dear Ajahn, there are two monk statues outside the meditation hall. They look exactly like you, loving, kind, and squat. They're about that high. No, we found those in a hardware shop when I was going to get something else, and they were there. I was like, "Oh, come on, let's get these." So we put them here. And they're, I think they're from Bali, I think, just like monk statues. So take one with you. They're really heavy. According to the Metta Sutta, the last one says, "Not born again into this world." What does this mean? Just this world? How about being born in other realms? Thank you. Yeah. So a sublime abiding is just means a lot of happiness. But these are a person who does this is saying gets reborn as anagami, non-returner. That's what it means. Not born in this world, in the anagami. They call it the Sudawasa, the pure abodes. And as somebody once said, you know, that maybe that's, you know, where in Mahayana they got the Pure Land from. But anyway, that's what it means there. So never get reborn in Islam. Many Mahayana Buddhists believe in Amitabha Buddha, Pure Land. Ha ha! They come together and chant his name to be born there. Did the Buddha talk about Amitabha's Pure Land? In the Sutta, the Pure Land Sutta, it says in the Pure Land, whatever you want, any food you want, you can just get it straight away. It's called Uber Eats. Any music, any type of music, you know, it's just there. What's it called? Not Netflix, it's Spotify. Spotify. So you can have Spotify now. And what else? Any entertainment. You can just get, just like that. You don't have to go to the movie theater. Netflix. Is that right, Netflix? Yeah. Okay, got that one right. So, you are in the Pure Land already. This is it. Congratulations, you've made it. I thought I made that up. I gave a talk about that, the Pure Land. I said, "You're already here. You don't need to chant Amitabha anymore. You're already here." And I knew enough about the sutta just to describe all the things which it said you'd experience. And said, "It's here. So you don't need to worry about going to the Pure Land. You already arrived. So now you practice." And apparently there was a Zen monk, I think about 30, 40 years ago. You know, he also taught like that. With respect to the little self-mutilating mouse, Does it have any friends? Mice are very sociable. Maybe it's lonely. Yeah, maybe it is. If it's very lonely, you can take it into my office. There's about three mice there. Click, 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 click. Computer mice. Self-mutilating mouse. Yeah, I don't know. Yeah, I mean, it probably is good to have a friend. Venerable Sir, could you at some point take us through the seven enlightenment factors? Mahakasapa Bojanga Sutra is especially inspiring. Yes, I can do that. Sometime later. That's what you asked for. I'm not sure how later that could be. That could be the next eon. That's what I said. Can you at some point take us through the seven enlightenment factors? Yeah, of course I can. Dear Ajahn, yesterday someone asked about colours they see during meditation. Because that will take a long time, that question. I also experience pulsating colours of colourful waves rolling through my visual field, but they happen too early to be inimitable since the sense of hearing and the physical perception are still very much intact at that point. Is that correct? You don't have to totally have all the five senses sort of stop to see a nimitta, because sometimes the nimittas come early, and this is especially, oh, here we go, my simile, five senses, the mind, the sixth sense. Usually you invest so much attention, time and energy into your five senses that they get, again, lots of attention, so their amplitude, their strength is huge, and your strength of your mind is actually quite low. But when you're meditating, you are calming down the five senses, putting energy into the mind. So this is actually increasing in power. The five senses are getting less of your attention. And there comes a time when they're about the same amplitude. And that's when you can start seeing the mind. There comes also the time the five senses really get low and the amplitude of the mind is very strong. So that's the time sometimes you can sort of hear, but the mind is just so strong. And especially if you've done lots of jhanas on a retreat, and you've a really strong mind, then that nimitta hardly leaves you. So even when you're eating your food, it's a big light there, it's like you have to eat through the nimitta. The senses are very, 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 very weak, and the lights, the mind is very, very strong. So that's actually, the five senses don't have to be totally subdued, but the mind has to be stronger, have to be more energized. And again, that's sometimes what happens when you've been meditating a lot and not being so engaged in the sensory world. So it could be a nimitta. And that this is the interesting thing which I sort of would make a point at is that I've been teaching this for such a long time, and when people come up and they say, oh, this wasn't really inhibited, it came too soon, it was too dull, not me, there's so much like self-negativity. Because when I talk to people, I really interrogate you, it was a limiter. Oh, no, it can't be, not me. It's just this, you know, this lack of self-respect. It's amazing how many Western people think they're not good enough. And something comes up, and you think, oh, it couldn't have been. A lot of time it was. So give yourself the benefit of the doubt. If you see this beautiful light or any old lights in the mind, it probably is. If from emptiness the mind naturally inclines towards nibbana, then could it be said we don't need insight? That is insight. Seeing inside. Going in, not seeing out there, going in, insight. So you can't, whether you need it or you don't need it, you're going to get it. So sometimes people say, oh, I'm practicing insight meditation, is that going to stop me? So look, if you practice insight meditation, you're going to get jhanas anyway. It just happens. It's not according to your preferences. It just happens because when things disappear, when you start letting go, these are just stages of letting go, stages of abandoning. You know, with insight, you just see, what am I holding on to this for? You just let it go. And it just happens. So You need insight, whatever you think you need, you don't need, it happens. Dear Ajahn, can we put some strict rule for people not to make noise after 10 p.m., e.g. boiling kettle, cleaning, etc.? I understand I disturb the noise, but I'm a beginner and still practicing patience. I'm not stable to sleep or waken up by noise. It's really agitated. Please help, thank you. Okay. Yeah, sometimes rules. Who's going to police the rules? Should I have a CCTV camera around the whole premises and in your bedrooms, so to make sure you get up in the morning, to make sure that no one has actually smuggled in instant noodles into the rooms for the evening, or if you're Westerner biscuits. You know, sometimes they're just, oh, come on, just be kind to yourself. But, you know, if it's the boiling kettle problem, then what you can do is actually just, I don't know if we've got, what's it called, thermoses? So you can fill a thermos up before 10 o'clock, and then it means in the morning time you don't have to go and boil the kettle. So we do have, actually, I don't know if we've got any others, in the teacher's cottage we've got the quiet boil kettle, which is very, very nice, it's very quick, and it makes very little noise. But anyway, if it's after 10, what do you want hot water for after 10? So if you want it for like a hot water bottle, you can do that beforehand. So just, if you possibly can, just don't boil the kettle before 10. So 11 p.m., that's before 10 the next day. That's why people said, oh, I can't eat in the afternoon. But sort of only eat before noon. And so right now is before noon tomorrow. Therefore I can eat. In other words, where there's a will, there's a loophole. So anyway, if you possibly can, maybe see if you can not do the kettle before that time. And if you really want to drink, you just walk into the kitchen. It's not that far. Bit of exercise, you can walk into the kitchen and get some hot water from there. Are there beings who are responsible that karma works, like Aniruddha's getting the cakes, like saying somehow it is not your time to die? Is it something the Buddha didn't explain? Well, it's weird, but sometimes the guardian devas, deva stories. There was this monk, Numpo Chop, and he was spending the Second World War period in Burma, in a monastery in Burma. He was a Thai monk. And when the war started there, and the Japanese took over Thailand, then all the Thais were considered to be sort of the enemies of the British Empire. Because, you know, they were taken over by the Japanese, and they thought the monks, especially the Thai monks, were Japanese spies. And because of that, as many of the Thai monks just were interrogated really badly by my ancestors, the British. And so that Lumpo Chop, who was in these monasteries in Burma, when they found out what was going on, they said, you better go back to Thailand as soon as possible. It's dangerous for a Thai monk in Burma during the Second World War. But they said, you can't go by the ordinary roads because, you know, the British soldiers were there on their checkpoints. The only way to safety would be go overland, over the mountains, to the jungle. And so he took this jungle path. And this was a long time ago, and it was many days without any villages, without any food. And the hills there, I mean, those hills were really steep to get up. Because I remember spending a rains retreat in one of those monasteries on the Burmese borders, and it was very, very basic. But anyway, he'd been walking for days without any food. And that's when he started to think, contemplate, I may not make this, I'm getting very, very weak. And as he was thinking like this, he remembered some of the stories in the time of the Buddha that heavenly beings would somehow sometimes look after monks, especially if they were good monks. And so thinking like this, he thought, I'm a good monk. He was a good monk, a good meditator, simple, kept his precepts. And he said, if there are such things as devas, maybe one can come and give me something to eat to save my life. And the only reason I tell that story was because it happened. You know, he was in the middle of nowhere, literally. You know, days from the nearest village. He turned a bend in the path an hour or so later, and there was this well-dressed gentleman standing with the tiffin cans. You know, they call it binto in Thai, the tiffin cans. I thought, this is really weird. Hadn't seen anybody, no human being, for days. And here is someone who's not dressed like a poor person living in the jungle. This was in really fashionable Bangkok gentleman dress. That was the first weird thing. You don't dress up like that in the jungle. Number two, he had this carrier. They usually have four trays. And a monk is not allowed just to say, you know, can you help me? If the monk is invited, you can actually take the food. So he walked quietly past this well-dressed gentleman, at which point the well-dressed gentleman said, Nimon Krap, which is the words of invitation to take something. And so the monk opened his bowl, and inside that tiffin can was hot rice, curries, fruits. Hot. There was no restaurant around. There is no, even in the jungles, they don't usually eat rice. They eat potatoes, because that's the only thing they have there. Or they eat sort of yams and fruit. And I remember what Ajahn Yana got once, monkey paw. That's all they've got to eat. And it's, but this was really high class curries, hot, and fruit. And this was so out of place. This person, how did he know a monk was coming? How did he have time to cook this food or get it? And just, how did he know this monk was there and coming and hungry? So the monk actually just broke a tradition and said to this man, where are you from? You're not really supposed to ask, just get the food and carry on, because it's so weird. And he said, the man with the food didn't talk. He just pointed upwards. So that was a very famous story of Lumpu Chop being helped to survive by a heavenly being. Hardly any other explanation. But of course, we're all skeptical. And I knew that story, I was taught that story. So many, many years afterwards, there was this young, very thin English monk. I was walking through the mountains of Phupan between Sakonakon and Kalasin, but Thai people know this. And it was not developed then. It was just, dirt roads, a couple of villages, just being settled, being developed. How many years ago was that? 40 years ago. And I was walking there on my tudong wandering. And I had a meal that morning, but there was no water. And I was getting dehydrated. And the sun was very strong that day. I was probably getting a bit of a heat stroke. And I hadn't seen any water or village for hours. And he got to a ridge in the hills, and in the valley there was a small village, five or six roofs. And I always knew, just from experience, that one of those houses would be the general store. So everything from kerosene to cigarettes and matches and just, the basics of existence there. And I also knew they would have there for sure some Pepsi Colas, sweet, bit of salt, pick me up. And I thought that, you know, I was a good monk. And I thought, if there are devas, I could really use a Pepsi. But I wasn't going to ask for it. And I made a determination. This was weird. I thought, well, let's see if there are devas, heavenly beings. I didn't really believe them, that they were there. But if there are, come on, do something useful. And so I made that resolution. And as I walked into that village, my eyes down, like I advise you to do your walking meditation, eyes down, not looking to the left or the right, in the corner of my eyes, I could see there was the general store. I walked right past it, no one stopped me. Devas didn't exist. And as I just gave up, just, okay, I gave you a try, hasn't worked. Nimon crap! Someone came running behind me, and with an open bottle of Pepsi Cola. I never asked or said anything. But okay, that might be just coincidence. And then another person ran up behind them with another bottle of open Pepsi Cola. Then another, and another, and another, and another, and another, and another. 9 bottles of Pepsi Cola, all opened. And anyone who knows Thailand, in Chinese, the lucky number is 8. Korea, 7. What's the lucky number in Thailand? 9, always 9. And I put them up in front of me, 9 bottles of Pepsi Cola. And I said, okay, I admit, I concede, devas do exist. And I just drank a little from each one, because no, you can't, no matter how thirsty you are, I can't drink 9 bottles of Pepsi Cola. And I gave the rest to some kids and other people. Thank you so much. And I just, from that moment on, I always knew there was such thing as a devas. They can help if you really need it. Weird. There's other devas stories, but, you know, go on all night. Very quickly. Are we getting somewhere in meditation practice, even if all we feel is frustration during a sitting? Are we building some kind of useful momentum? In a sense, yes, because that story of the migrant, I think I told the migrant story already, didn't I? Who came to Australia? Oh, I think in the interviews. Migrant came to Australia, highly qualified, but you know his qualifications weren't recognised. So I had to get a job anyway, got a job on a building site, labouring. Worked his butt off, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, really worked hard. Every night when he came home, how much did you earn tonight, darling, said his wife, nothing. Tuesday night, nothing. Wednesday night, nothing. Just, you know, Australians, they just exploit migrants and foreigners. But, you know, he went to work on Thursday as well and tried it again. Again, totally exploited, not paid anything. Made to work, just labouring jobs. Oh, didn't like being here. And on Friday, he didn't have anywhere else to go, so he went to work anyway. And on Friday, the boss called him over and gave him this big pay packet. Lots of dollars. And sent him home early as well. And then when he went home, his wife said, how did it go? I finally figured out how it works in Australia. From now on, I'm only going to go to work on Friday. And that is what happens when people get a good meditation. You want to only get the pay packet. You don't want to do the work beforehand. So sometimes, yeah, you're meditating, you know, you're getting frustrated because you haven't been paid yet. But you're building up the credit, so just wait, the check's in the mail. Dwajan Bum, I have very good sitting when I can only hear breathing far away in front of me than very clear light. But when I open my eyes, it's only 30 minutes sitting. Is it possible to have jhana in short time? Probably not, but what do you want jhana for? You're having a nice peaceful sitting, it's nice and calm, that's good enough. But don't be contented and easily satisfied. So you don't need that much. So when you're happy with this, oh, that's good enough for me. Oh, it's really nice. Then the jhanas come. Where does morality come from? Are some acts always wrong, or should Buddhists adopt a more spontaneous morality based on feelings in the moment? Please guide us on how we should determine right and wrong, and if there is such a thing. And a lot of times when you have these moral dilemmas, you know, when, you know, it's, you don't know, you know, say that somebody has a kid in their womb, but they're going to be deformed. They're not going to really live a very good life. They probably won't even get past the birth moment. And should you abort or should you not abort? And if you're a mother, this is not just a philosophical question. This is real. And what I often advise is you just really feel it in here. How do you feel about this? And you trust, you know, your, you know, they call it gut feeling, your intuition. Everyone's got intuition. That is a main guide. Somehow you feel it's wrong. And the key story to that, back to the Vietnam War, back to there, because I was around in those days. I didn't go to Vietnam in the war, thank goodness. But there was the My Lai massacre, Lieutenant Kelly. If those of you remember that, there's a whole group of soldiers, was platoon or I don't know how many, or what, quite a few. They got orders to go to the village of My Lai, probably pronounced it wrong, and to shoot, kill every man, woman and child. It's supposed to be a hotbed of Viet Cong. Everyone, that was the order. Of course, later on, a journalist witnessed that and obviously told the news outlets about it. It was a war crime. Lieutenant Kelly was court-martialed, put in jail, and pardoned. But, you know, I think it was a presidential pardon. But it was a massacre. It was just genocide. It was just really wrong. But then some enterprising journalists, psychologists, whatever, they wanted to see the aftermath of that. You know, I think it was 50 years on, or 40 years on, I forget how long. So they tried to find as many of those people who participated in that massacre and interview them. And every one of those soldiers who went in under orders to shoot men, women and children indiscriminately, they all had huge psychological problems, social problems, alcoholism, drugs, couldn't hold a relationship together, couldn't keep their jobs. They were messes, psychologically, even health problems as well. It was a good example of karma. But there's always one or two people stood out, you know, that what you can actually compare. And there was this one African-American soldier, and he had refused to go in. And they asked him, said, how can you actually do that? Because you know what, the consequence was about 3 or 4 years in military jail, which is much worse than civilian jail. He said, do you know what the consequence, you go into military jail? He said, yes, I knew that. I had to, because it was wrong. I couldn't do it. He said, well, you know, were you religious? He said, no, not religious. Why did you join the army? Just to get out of the slums, you know, where I grew up. It was the only way to actually escape from poverty or drug dealing or an early death. So I joined the military to get a life. I hadn't much education. I didn't go to college. But he said, I felt this was wrong. I just couldn't do it. And he had the guts to follow that feeling. He suffered in military jail, but he was the one person who was happy, well integrated, in a great family. He stood the ground. He could not sort of explain it. He just felt it was wrong, and he followed that. And the consequences were that he was a happy person, a well integrated person. I always liked that story. Much morality. We say, oh, no. You know, find some book somewhere. Find some teaching, find some teacher who can justify what you want to do. Just like when I went on a radio show once, live, taking calls from the public, and I didn't realize what I was up to. I was really heedless because it was a show on adult sexual matters. I was a muck. And I was taking calls about, you know what dysfunctions and stuff. All sorts of really weird calls. But I never had that before, so it was quite interesting. But this one guy, a taxi driver, because they listen to these programs late at night, and he was actually asking, he asked it straight up. He said, I'm having an affair with a beautiful woman. My wife doesn't know. Is that okay? And I replied, no, without hesitation, I said, sir, if it was okay, you would not be ringing me up to ask. He was only ringing me up because he was guilty and he wanted some expert to somehow argue him out of his remorse because he was cheating on his wife. If it was right, sir, you would not be ringing me up to ask. And as soon as I said that, he hung up straight away. I nailed him straight away. And so that's sometimes why we look for experts to actually to try and convince us that what we know is wrong is okay. So sometimes we know, and if we can trust that inner moral compass, I think it's much more powerful and reliable than on books. Ajahn Brahm, only 5 more days left. Thank you. Oh, okay. You can always go early or come back. How did you spend your days as a novice monk? Novice, you know what novice means? No vice. So I spent my days as a novice monk without any vice. No vice. You know what vice means, like defilements and stuff. Are most humans going to be reborn as humans next life? If they practice Dharma in this life, would they get opportunities to continue the practice next life? Yeah, of course. Sometimes the way you incline, if a tree is leaning to the right when it falls, or leaning to the west when it falls, it's likely to fall to the west. So inclination, remember that story I said about that guy Rod Howell? Before Dan Leno, he was an entertainer in a previous life. He was inclined to be that in his next life. So, you know, it's amazing if you find your past life, sometimes we're inclining to a certain character, a certain lifestyle, and we do that in our next life as well. Dear Ajahn Brahm, hope you get to my note last or close to last. Your wishes have been fulfilled. You are like a father telling us all of your children bedtime stories. A kind of father I never had when I was little. Thank you and good night. That's nice, isn't it? So, tuck yourself in. Make sure you brush your teeth before you go to sleep. And have a lovely night. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Okay, that's a nice ending.